Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1024. More about Ukrainian fascism, Maidan, snipers, and implications for the Syrian war. This is being recorded on September 11th of 2018. Of course, that is the 17th anniversary of September 11th. I'm going to move relatively briskly through the remaining sections, and this will admittedly be a very dry presentation, even by the normally arid aesthetic that this program admittedly entails. On August 30th through early September, there was a presentation of the American Political Studies Associate and Professor Ivan Kachanovsky of the University of Ottawa presented The Maidan Massacre in Ukraine, Revelations from Trials and Investigations. And I would note that there is a link since I recorded For the Record 1023, much of which consisted of the reading of this document. Professor Kachanovsky has posted a 59-minute-long video of the Maidan shootings, which you can download, and it makes it very clear that basically there was a cover-up of the shootings of protesters and police from Maidan-controlled buildings. In light of the fact, the unavoidable fact that this is radio, there really isn't much I can do about that, about presenting that. But there is a link to this, to the 59-minute-long video of the Maidan shootings, and it presents some pretty conclusive evidence that protesters and police were shot from Maidan-controlled buildings. The so-called captain of the Maidan, Andrei Parubiy, now the Speaker of the Ukrainian Parliament, is a key member of the OUNB successor milieu in Ukraine, and he was basically in charge of the Maidan operations. Many have charged him with being an accessory to alleged Georgian snipers who fired on the protesters and the police. We went into this at some length in For the Record 1023, and there is a link and an overview of Professor Kachanovsky's work. As we are speaking, or as I am speaking, as we are on the 17th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, I think the implications of Western media, the U.S. government, and associates to cover up the, at this point, very firm evidence of the Maidan shootings as being a false flag operation looms very large and very ominously for what is, I suspect, waiting in the wings in Syria. The Syrian government, with Russian military support, is beginning an offensive to retake the last major jihadist enclave in Syria, Idlib's IDLIB province. And as we will see, that province is dominated by al-Qaeda-linked militias. The U.S. and Britain and France and now Germany is talking about joining any forthcoming military operation in Syria, have warned of consequences if, in fact, the Syrian government uses chemical weapons in that offensive. We have done programs, and I have posted food for thought articles about the chemical weapons attacks in Syria, and the evidence points very strongly to those as being not only provocations, but provocations that were authored by some of the al-Qaeda-linked jihadi militias themselves. with those militias almost certainly poised to be on the losing side of an offensive, which also figures to be quite bloody for the civilians trapped in the combat grounds, so to speak. I think the stage is altogether set for the al-Qaeda-linked militias to stage a chemical attack, which will then, according to fashion, be blamed on the Syrian government and, of course, the Russians. And this will result in certainly U.S., French, British, and possibly German military action against the Syrian government. And it may actually set the stage for clashes between the U.S. and other Western military forces and Russians. I think part of the game in some quarters in this country would be to deal a blow to Putin by bloodying or destroying Russian military forces in Syria, hopefully to precipitate the toppling of Vladimir Putin. At the same time, this would effectively negate any suspicion in this country of collusion between Trump and Russia. We have done a great deal of material about the Russiagate quandary as a psyop. If, in fact, a triumphant American military action against the hated Ruskies could be precipitated in Syria, this would resonate very well in this country. It would certainly guard Trump's rump, so to speak, on the Russiagate question. And it just might, in addition to weakening, if not toppling, Vladimir Putin in Russia, certainly something that the West wants, it just might help avert any kind of blue wave in the 2018 midterm elections in this country. I, for one, am not convinced that such a blue wave will take place. We'll see. There are a lot of different things going on. But I think with the Syrian and Russian-backed offensive now commencing in Syria with al-Qaeda, in Idlib province, with the discussion, with the threat by John Bolton and others that the U.S. will intervene, and France and Britain have said the same thing. I think the stage is set for some extremely dangerous occurrences, not the least of which would be direct U.S.-Russian military conflict, although, again, I think ultimately the U.S. and the West would prevail in such a conflict. This would weaken Putin, but above all, it would certainly guard Trump's rump against the Russiagate collusion charges, as spurious as those are, frankly. We've spoken about Manafort at great length, including our last two shows. It would certainly strengthen the hand of the GOP and Trump in the midterm elections. It would weaken Putin. And, well, more about that when the time, later on in the program. I've also noted a major media blitzkrieg by the New York Times and British media about the alleged poisoning of Mr. Skripal by the FSB, Russian intelligence. It is, frankly, to a trained intelligence observer, ludicrous for reasons I'll go into. I suspect that they are setting the stage for, you know, yes, the Russian-backed Syrians use chemical weapons, and well, what do you expect from the Russians? There is no reason for Russia to have poisoned Mr. Skripal if, in fact, they wanted to get rid of him. There are any number of completely undetectable technologies that could be used to dispatch him, and the comical non-lethal poisoning of Mr. Skripal, and then the release of an alleged video of the poisoners in which the alleged perps look like nothing so much as the Hollywood conception of Russian mobsters, complete with black, dark clothing, black watch caps et al. is, again, to a trained observer, frankly, ludicrous, but then the American people have fallen for an awful lot of nonsense. And after the 2016 shadow broker's alleged hack involving the use of Boris and Natasha-like broken Russian-accented English, who knows? I guess just about anything may work. But again, there is a link in the written description for the record 1024 for Professor Kaczynowski's presentation on the Maidan massacres as a false flag operation, and a link to a 59-minute-long video featuring television footage of the Maidan shootings. And I strongly urge members of the audience to take advantage of this. Simply reading the headings of the document on the air is very dry. I'm going to finish up doing that and overlap that with what we had in the previous program.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Well, this, again, is from Ivan Kaczynowski, again, a Ukrainian-born professor at the University of Ottawa in Canada. The Maidan Massacre in Ukraine, Revelations from Trials and Investigations. This poster was presented at the 2018 Conference of the American Political Studies Associates from August 30th through September 1st of 2018. And we're going to skip right down to the section called Cover-Up and Stonewalling. And in that we find this is overlap with our presentation in the last show. Investigation denies that there were snipers in Maidan-controlled buildings and does not investigate them, in spite of overwhelming evidence revealed by investigation and trial and publicly available evidence, such as testimonies by over 100 wounded protesters and over 200 witnesses, and videos, photos, and audio of snipers in and on these buildings, including their shooting at protesters and police. By the way, the poster presented by Professor Kaczynowski has extensive video documentation of all of this. The Prosecutor General of Ukraine, who was one of the top Maidan politicians, declared that the investigation of the Maidan massacre is de facto completed. Public statements by six Maidan politicians and activists and five Georgians about involvement of snipers and Maidan leaders in the massacre and its cover-up have not been investigated. The ex-president of Georgia, hastily detained and expelled from Ukraine a day before his testimony concerning Georgian snipers, unquote, at the Maidan massacre trial. Similarly, a public statement by a Maidan member of the parliament that one of the Tituski leaders, that's T-I-T-U-S-K-Y leaders, who was involved in killing a journalist on February 19th, worked for a business of leading Maidan activists, and that they knew about the massacre in advance also has not been investigated. Failure by the investigation to determine bullet trajectories with the help of forensic ballistic experts, even after the Maidan massacre trial ordered such examinations, specifically to determine if these trajectories were from the Maidan-controlled buildings. The investigation, instead of ballistic experts, used complex forensic examinations by medics to determine sectors of fire without on-site visits and any measurements and explanations provided. At least several dozens of such examinations were conducted by the same three medical experts during the last weeks of the investigation. Not ballistic experts, but architects from a U.S. architecture company were hired by Maidan victims' lawyers with involvement of the prosecution to determine bullet trajectories of three selected killed protesters out of 49 killed and 157 wounded protesters for the trial concerning the February 20th Maidan massacre. Both these complex medical examinations and the 3D model by New York architecture company provided practically identical bullet trajectories and sectors of fire from the Bearcroot barricades on the grounds in the cases of these three killed protesters. But wounds, locations, and the steep slopes of the entry and exit wounds in forensic medical examinations used both by the medical and architectural experts in determining these ballistic trajectories differ significantly from their locations and nearly horizontal levels in the 3D model by Situs SITU research. This concerns not only the wounds of Dmitriev, but also Dyatlovich and Parashuk wounds. Those are some of the people who were shot on the Maidan. Bullet wounds, locations, and their steep slopes along with bullet holes appearing in shields right after their killings in the same spot within 2 minutes, and the testimony of a protester who was in the same spot that he saw the Dyatlovich shot by a sniper on the bank Arcata, point to the top of this building as a location of snipers who killed both Dyatlovich and Dmitriev. These bullet holes and the testimonies of two protesters who witnessed their killings about snipers in Maidan-controlled buildings shooting Dyatlovich and Dmitriev were not mentioned at the trial. Similarly, videos and audio recordings of snipers in Maidan-controlled buildings and publicly available testimonies of numerous other Maidan protesters about such snipers were not mentioned by the investigation and at the Maidan massacre trial. The landscape, the street, and the trees on the site of the massacre would be almost completely changed into a park and a new Maidan massacre museum by the February of 2019, and it will be physically impossible to conduct on-site investigative experiments to determine bullet trajectories. This reminds me a lot of the redoing of the area around the Lorraine Motel in the immediate aftermath of the assassination of Martin Luther King. Trees and shrubs, which would have precluded a shot from the rooming house that allegedly killed Martin Luther King, that pruning of trees and of shrubs basically removed evidence that would have precluded the official version of the killing of Martin Luther King. Something somewhat analogous, I think, is in evidence here. The landscape, the street, and trees on the site of the massacre would be almost completely changed into a park and a new Maidan Massacre Museum by February of 2019, and it will be physically impossible to conduct on-site investigative experiments to determine bullet trajectories. A new ballistic expert examination of bullets that was ordered by the Maidan Massacre trial has not started for more than 1 year after the court decision. No forensic video and audio examinations were conducted by the official investigation. The next section, the Prosecutor General Office reversed, without any explanations, their own previous investigation findings. Admissions that protesters were massacred by snipers from the Hotel Ukraine from SKS carbines, and that at least three protesters were killed from this hotel, and 10 others were also killed from significant heights. Investigations of the massacres of the police and the protesters were separated, even though they happened on the same days and in the same places. No forensic examinations, comparisons of bullets extracted from bodies of the police and the protesters, in spite of various evidence that they were shot by the same groups of snipers. Similar unexplained reversals of forensic examinations of bullets and directions of wounds of protesters a few weeks before the investigation submitted the case to a court for trial. That last sentence again. Similar unexplained reversals of forensic examinations of bullets and directions of wounds of protesters a few weeks before the investigation submitted the case to a court for trial. Similar unexplained reversals at the trial testimonies of many wounded protesters previously provided to the investigation. The Prosecutor General Office has been headed by Maidan politicians or close allies of the current president of Ukraine, and the investigation of the massacre has been under the control of the Maidan government leaders from the start. Two factions of main ruling Maidan parties blocked creation of a parliamentary commission concerning the Maidan massacre investigation. Key pieces of forensic evidence of the massacre on February 20th disappeared when it was under the Maidan opposition or Maidan government control, or when it was in the possession of the Maidan government investigation without anyone responsible identified and prosecuted. Almost all of the shields and helmets of killed and wounded protesters, since bullet holes in them or their absence could identify locations of the shooters. Many bullets extracted from bodies of the protesters and the police, trees, soil, a flower box, and the Maidan buildings. Some trees with bullets and or bullet holes were cut soon after the massacre, and the prosecution admitted this 3 years afterwards. Again, the doctoring of the area around the Lorraine Motel in the assassination of President Kennedy, of Martin Luther King, rather, comes to mind. Recordings of live online streams and other videos from the time of shooting at the police from the Maidan-controlled buildings in the early morning of February 20th. Security camera recordings from the Hotel Ukraina, the Bank Arcata, and other Maidan-controlled buildings at the time when snipers were located there. Bullets extracted from the bodies of protesters in Khmelnytsky. A leader of a Maidan organization and its members were revealed and investigated by the Prosecutor General Office for evacuating and hiding firearms of the Special Berkut Company charged with the massacre of the protesters on February 20th. By the way, we've spoken about how the person who took the weapons and dumped them in a lake was, in the words of a prosecutor, with us, unquote, on the Maidan. In other words, he was one of the pro-Maidan or Euro-Maidan protesters. No one was charged with killing and wounding the majority of Maidan protesters on February 18th through 19th. One more time, this the title for this section. No one was charged with killing and wounding the majority of Maidan protesters on February 18th through 19th. Berkut policemen charged with killing the first three protesters and wounding 33 protesters on February 18th were released by the courts and allowed by the law enforcement to flee Ukraine. The same concerns a Berkut commander whose company was charged with killing 48 protesters on February 20th. Forensic evidence in killings of protesters and the police on February 18th through 19th has yet to be made public. A protester who killed another protester by driving him over in a seized truck and was tried was released under an amnesty law for crimes committed by Maidan protesters during the Euro-Maidan. Nobody is charged with the killing of a Georgian protester on February 20th, and the circumstances of his killing and its investigation have not been made public. No one was charged and tried for the killing and wounding of policemen on February 18th through 20th. The charges of killing two policemen against one sniper who publicly admitted this in the Ukrainian media were dropped and replaced by milder charges by the Prosecutor General of Ukraine. The Maidan massacre trial was restarted from the beginning and has not completed the testimonies of relatives of killed and wounded protesters, and it would not produce a verdict before the 2019 presidential elections. Several attacks by the neo-Nazi Combat 14 and other far-right groups disrupted and threatened the trial. Why would they do that, one wonders? C-14 or Combat 14 took refuge in the Canadian embassy shortly before the Maidan massacre, and one of its leaders stated that the Combat 14 knew about the massacre in advance. no such evidence of a systematic cover-up by the Yanukovych government leaders and Berkut members. Yanukovych treason trial revealed various evidence, pieces of evidence, that he fled Ukraine following several assassination attempts by Maidan forces, including those of the far right. Yanukovych, his ministers, and internal troops ex-commander volunteered to testify via video links about the massacre at the trials. An absolute majority of Berkut police members who were charged with the massacre did not flee Ukraine until they were to be charged with the massacre or after they were charged. Not a single person has been convicted for killing and wounding some 100 protesters and the police on February 18th through 20th of 2014. And then the conclusion reached by Professor Kaczynowski, the Maidan massacre trial and investigative evidence have revealed various pieces of evidence that at least the absolute majority of the 49 killed and 157 wounded Maidan protesters on February 20th, 2014, were massacred by snipers in Maidan-controlled buildings. Such evidence includes testimonies of the majority of wounded protesters and many witnesses, forensic medical and ballistic examinations, and investigations' own finding that about half of Maidan protesters were wounded from locations other than those of the Berkut police. Various indications of stonewalling of the Maidan massacre investigations and the trials by the Maidan government officials and by far-right investigations. Various indications of the cover-up of much of the key evidence of the massacre. Such revelations from the Maidan massacre trials and investigations corroborates previous studies finding that this massacre was a false flag mass killing with the involvement of elements of Maidan leadership and the far right, and that it included the massacre of the police. The puzzling misinterpretation of the Maidan massacre, its investigation, and the trial by Western media and Western governments require further research concerning the reasons for such misrepresentation. I wonder if Professor Kaczynowski had his tongue in his cheek when he wrote that. I realize that this has been, an extremely dry presentation, perhaps unintelligible. I've been reading information from the detailed and video supplemented poster that was created by Professor Kaczynowski. He also has a 59-minute video that one can download, featuring television footage of the Maidan demonstrations and massacre. I recommend emphatically that listeners to this program download, basically visit that poster and download that video. Some background on the alleged investigation of the Maidan shootings from the Union.info blog of July 24th of 2016. Prosecutors say public to face unpleasant surprise in Maidan killings probe. And it talks about how one of the people, as written here, unfortunately, this man, who, according to our version, upon the orders of former Interior Minister Vitaly Zatarenko, helped the Black Hundred, that is the Yanukovych Berkut police, flee Kiev, destroyed and drowned their weapons, he himself was with us on the Maidan, according to Prosecutor Lutsenko. Now note the following. Earlier, the Deputy Prosecutor General of Ukraine, Chief Military Prosecutor Anatoly Anatoly Matios, Matios, said, quote, "When public learns who is involved in this, people will be very surprised," unquote. Well, I don't know who that would be, but some perspective on this fellow. Again, the Deputy Prosecutor General of Ukraine and the Chief military prosecutor of Ukraine, Anatoly Matvios, can be gleaned from the Newsweek article of June 27th of this year, 2018. Jews want to drown Ukraine in blood, Ukraine's military prosecutor says, amid wave of racist and anti-Semitic attacks. This by Christina Meza, or Maza, M-A-Z-A. In an extensive interview with the Ukrainian news outlet Insider, Anatoly Matvios, Ukraine's chief military prosecutor, espoused anti-Semitic conspiracy theories in which he implied that Jews want to drown ethnic Slavs in blood. Now, again, I've covered this in past programs, the point being that for all practical purposes, one of the key investigators, the Deputy Prosecutor General of Ukraine and Ukraine's chief military prosecutor, Anatoly Matvios, is basically, for all intents and purposes, a Nazi. We've also spoken in the past about how a top Ukrainian fascist, the Azov Battalion's number two man, Ihor Mosichuk, was sentenced to prison for a, that is, the man who went on to become the number two man in the Azov Battalion when it was formed, was sentenced to prison for a planned bombing in January of 2014. His supporters demonstrated on his behalf on the Maidan, and that helped to create the turmoil that led momentum to the Yanukovych, anti-Yanukovych demonstrations that resulted in not only the sniper shootings, but also eventually to Yanukovych's ouster. One of the sources of that, GermanForeignPolicy.com, an article called Ukrainian Patriots from July 30th of 2014, that is in the written description for the program. Now, again, we are on, this is being recorded on the 17th anniversary of September 11th. And as I mentioned, there is an offensive underway or beginning in Syria by the Syrian army, backed by Russian military, to oust the jihadist militias from their last major stronghold in Syria, that being Idlib province. In both programs and posts, including about a recent alleged chemical attack by the Syrian government, we noted that the available evidence suggested very strongly that these were either, in many cases, either launched by the rebels themselves as provocation, or perhaps when chemicals were hit by conventional munitions. There would be no reason for Assad's military to take these steps, inviting retribution and discreditation when they were winning the military conflict hands down using conventional weapons. Again, there will be links to the posts and article and programs in the written description for the broadcast. Now, I've noted in the past that Al-Qaeda, along with Hamas, and time permitting as we will see, ISIS, or the Islamic State, are offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic fascist organization that fought with the Axis in World War II, was then taken on by Western intel, including and especially the CIA, to be used not only to suppress communism in the Muslim world, but also to spawn the Afghan Mujahideen that fought in the first Afghan war and helped to bring about the downfall of the former Soviet Union. That, of course, morphed directly into Al-Qaeda. And as we have looked at in many programs, Al-Qaeda has continued to function as proxy warriors in the Caucasus, in the Balkans, and elsewhere. That, in my opinion, is one of the main reasons for the cover-up of September 11th and for the generation of the unconscionable controlled demolition nonsense that discredits any investigation into September 11th by basically papering it over with a bunch of readily verifiable nonsense. In, for the record, 733 through 739, I went into the Arab Spring, or the Muslim Brotherhood Spring, as I called it, and spoke about how that was basically the alleged Arab Spring was actually a Western intelligence operation intended to, among other things, bring the Muslim Brotherhood to power, in part at least because of their corporatist economics. There is a remarkable article from 2006 called Islam in Office by Stephen Glane. We'll review part of this in our next program. And Stephen Glane talks about how Western corporatist interests are on the same page as the Muslim Brotherhood. And specifically, he talks about the Muslim Brotherhood's key economic theoretician, a 14th century theoretician named Ibn Khaldun, that's Ibn Khaldun, whom the World Bank recognizes as the first advocate of privatization. That, in a nutshell, is the key element of resonance between the Muslim Brotherhood and the international or the transnational corporate community. Also, the various Muslim Brotherhood spawned combatant organizations, including Al-Qaeda, have proved to be very useful proxy warriors, not only against the Soviets in Afghanistan, but against Russia in the Caucasus and in the Balkans as well. And again, in Idlib province, which is the focal point of an imminent offensive, really it appears to have begun, by the Syrian army with Russian backing, and something that the West, the U.S. in particular, has warned will produce some devastating civilian casualties, as is often the case in civil wars. The West and the U.S. in particular have warned if Bashar al-Assad uses chemical weapons, then this will invite a military response by the West. I think the stage is set for a provocation for the al-Qaeda guerrillas in Idlib province to stage a chemical weapons attack / provocation, thereby drawing in the U.S., Britain, France, and possibly Germany into something that could very easily result in a Western-Russian military conflict. And how far that goes, well, who knows?
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
In this context, a very thoughtful column also appeared in German Foreign Policy of September 3rd of 2018. It's called, quote, Rebels, unquote. It reads in part, Berlin and the EU are intensifying pressure on Damascus in view of the Syrian troops' presumed imminent offensive in Idlib province against jihadi militias, including al-Qaeda's Syrian offshoot. According to a German government spokesperson, it is, quote, anticipated, unquote, that the Russian government will, quote, restrain the Syrian regime's escalation, unquote. Washington is threatening an unspecified intervention, beginning again, Washington is threatening an unspecified intervention should chemical weapons be used. Syrian jihadists have used chemical weapons in the past and would be in a position to provoke this U.S. intervention. Since last summer, the Syrian al-Qaeda offshoot Hayat Tahrir al-Sham is in control of Idlib province with some 30,000 combatants. Additional smaller, mostly Salafist jihadi militias are also ready to battle the Syrian army. By referring to them as, quote, rebels, unquote, politicians and media are downplaying the jihadists, including al-Qaeda, as the 17th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks approaches. Already in the summer of 2017, the Syrian offshoot of al-Qaeda, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, formerly al-Nusra, had prevailed over rival insurgent militias in fierce battles in Idlib province. The al-Qaeda-linked Hayat Tahrir al-Sham was tolerating some other armed cliques as long as they were essentially submitting to its rule. Quote, "But there is no longer any question who is ultimately in charge in Idlib province," the Syrian expert Aaron Lund, L-U-N-D, wrote in August of 2017, calling Idlib a de facto jihadi emirate. At the time, experts on the region assessed that the Western powers could have no interest in defending the al-Qaeda regime. Al-Qaeda is temporarily refraining from large-scale terrorism in the West because it prioritizes the stabilization of its structures, the U.S.-American Council on Foreign Relations wrote in March. The terror attack against the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo and the St. Petersburg metro bombing, both being ascribed to al-Qaeda, prove that the organization has not given up its old strategy. The Syrian expert Sam Heller, who today is working for the International Crisis Group, speculated in May of 2017 that, quote, "someone," unquote, will most likely put an end to those activists in Idlib soon. It could be either the West or the Syrian government with support from Moscow, because for both, quote, "a big jihadist safe haven is intolerable." And then skipping down. And yet currently, Western politicians and media are against Syria and Russia much more than they are against al-Qaeda. Thus, al-Qaeda-dominated jihadi militias in Idlib are regularly euphemized as, quote, "rebels," unquote, and the province itself as a, quote, "rebel stronghold," unquote. If one goes along with this terminology, which comes quite close to the way the jihadis see themselves, then al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri and his predecessor Osama bin Laden must be, quote, "rebel leaders," unquote, and the terrorists of Paris and St. Petersburg would have been acting in the name of a, quote, "rebel organization," unquote. Otherwise, this pattern of argumentation resembles that during the combat waged by the Syrian army against Salafists and jihadis for East Aleppo, East Ghouta, and more recently for Daraa. Warnings of massacres at the hands of Syrian troops and the supporting Russian military are already being propagated in advance. According to a German government spokesperson who expressed that the government is, quote, "very worried about the escalation of the situation in northwest Syria," unquote, and anticipates, unquote, that Moscow, again quoting, "will restrain the Syrian government from an escalation, thereby averting a humanitarian catastrophe," unquote, "we must prevent military engagements in Idlib that could lead to a humanitarian catastrophe," announced Federica Mogherini, EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security. Further escalation of this argumentation is easily possible. For example, in the German media, it was claimed that the battle over East Aleppo that the Syrian military was Further escalation of this argumentation is easily possible. This article, by the way, was translated into English from German, so there are some awkward passages. For example, in the German media, it was claimed during the battle over East Aleppo that the Syrian military was committing, quote, "genocide," unquote, in the city. What was happening there was, quote, "worse than Auschwitz," unquote. On the other hand, German politicians and media have had no criticism of the bloody battles waged for Fallujah, Mosul, and Raqqa, which have been carried out by Western military forces. Aside from regrets at the loss of civilian lives, these battles are still today being celebrated as heroic victories over jihadis. But in fact, the battles waged by the West had differed little from those waged by Syria and Russia in terms of the large number of deaths and the extent of destruction. A team of UN High Commission for Refugees even declared in the spring that the extent of destruction in Raqqa had, quote, exceeded anything, unquote, they had, again quoting, ever seen before. Raqqa had not been devastated by Syrians and Russians in the course of the war against ISIS, but rather by Western airstrikes using reconnaissance data provided by the Bundeswehr in collaboration with pro-Western troops on the ground. Whether this will simply remain a case of negative coverage of the upcoming battle for Idlib, or whether individual Western powers will intervene, remains uncertain. A few days ago, the USA, Great Britain, and France published a statement wherein they expressed their, quote, serious concern over reports, unquote, according to which, again quoting, the Syrian regime is preparing a military offensive against civilians and the civilian infrastructure in Idlib, unquote. They are also, quote, worried, unquote, that the Syrian military forces will probably use chemical weapons. If this happens, the three countries are, quote, determined to take action, unquote. Subsequently, U.S. President Donald Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton affirmed that the USA would react, quote, very strongly, unquote, should there be a chemical weapons attack. In fact, the Western powers are giving jihadi militias in Idlib an option. Should those militias not be able to vanquish the Syrian military, they can feign a chemical weapons attack, and the West will intervene on their side. The Syrian jihadis have already used chemical weapons and therefore know how to do so is well known. A Western attack against Syrian forces in or around Idlib in the current situation would help the Syrian offshoot of Al-Qaeda. And again, I think the stage is set for something like that. If, in fact, there is an all-out escalation in Syria, and my guess is that the West would ultimately prevail over the Russian military, this would damage Putin politically, and I think that is perhaps intended and ultimately they hope will lead to the downfall of Putin. Perhaps even more saliently is the fact that this would certainly cover Trump's rump in the Russiagate collusion question in time for the 2018 midterm elections. It would certainly give Republicans a major talking point in their campaigns in the midterm elections, and if Trump could thump his chest and Bolton could thump his chest and say, see, we whipped the Ruskies, after the whole Russiagate psyop and the notion of Russia being behind the high-profile hacks and all of this. Well, we've done many programs about that. We will also review some of that information. It is, to make a long story short, pure, unadulterated, fresh fertilizer. There is nothing to it. It is a psyop. And I think that the Russia interfered in our elections a bit will lead to some very celebratory pronouncements on the part of not just Republicans, but also Democrats, if in fact we can bloody the Russians in Syria. And with the stage set for the al-Qaeda-linked jihadist militias in Syria to stage another chemical attack, and there is evidence they have already done that, and there will be links in the written description for the program, I think the stage for the forecast intervention by John Bolton et al., if their chemical weapons are used, they may even intervene if there are high civilian casualties, and they're figured to be. It is a densely populated area, and if the formidable capabilities of modern weaponry are brought to bear in such a conflict, there will undoubtedly be a lot of civilian casualties. I think that the stage is set for a possible provocation and for a possible U.S., Russian, or Western Russian military conflict, which again will be seen as weakening Putin politically and, above all, I think, covering Trump's rump in the midterm elections and perhaps preventing a blue wave in the upcoming midterm elections. I, for one, am not convinced that there will be a blue wave. There may be. We'll see. But certainly that would bolster the Republicans and cover Trump's rump. The Russiagate thing will not carry much weight if, in fact, Trump bloodies the Russians in Syria.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
In our next program, we're going to leave off from the Ukraine for a couple of shows and then come back to Ukraine because the Serpent's Walk scenario, basically World War II history being not just rewritten, but stood on its head in Ukraine, and perhaps even more importantly, with resonance, with corresponding resonance in Western media, including the U.S., I think the importance of what is taking place in Ukraine could not be exaggerated, but the events in Syria and revisiting the Arab Spring, or as I called it in For the Record, 733, for through 739, the Muslim Brotherhood Spring, the importance of that could not be exaggerated. I'm going to conclude this program with a partial reading of an article that we will read in its entirety in our next program. It was alluded to in that German foreign policy article. It is a mainstream Western or Eastern establishment point of view. It is from the Council on Foreign Relations, the very essence, perhaps, of the Eastern establishment, and it is from March 6th of this year being 2018. The author of this paper is Bruce Hoffman, H-O-F-F-M-A-N. I believe he formerly was with the RAND Corporation, perhaps is still with the RAND Corporation. It's worth noting the title is Al-Qaeda's Resurrection, as I read this on September 11th of 2018. Note what he states here. We'll cover this at length in our next program. While the self-proclaimed Islamic State has dominated the headlines and preoccupied national security officials for the past 4 years, Al-Qaeda has been quietly rebuilding. Its announcement last summer of another affiliate, this one dedicated to the liberation of Kashmir, coupled with the resurrection of its presence in Afghanistan and the solidification of its influence in Syria, Yemen, and Somalia, underscores the resiliency and continued vitality of the U.S.'s preeminent terrorist enemy. Although Al-Qaeda's rebuilding and reorganization predates the 2011 Arab Spring, the upheaval that followed helped the movement revive itself. At the time, an unbridled optimism among local and regional rights activists and Western governments held that a combination of popular protest, civil disobedience, and social media had rendered terrorism an irrelevant anachronism. The longing for democracy and economic reform, it was argued, had decisively trumped, no pun intended, repression and violence. However, where the optimists saw irreversible positive change, Al-Qaeda discerned new and inviting opportunities. I would submit that it was specifically to resurrect or to bolster the Muslim Brotherhood and its corporatist slash Ibn Khaldun economics and Al-Qaeda that the, quote, Arab Spring, I called it the Muslim Brotherhood Spring, was actually activated. The U.S. or elements of U.S. intel and the national security establishment are playing both sides, working both sides of the street. There is an altogether sincere anti-Al-Qaeda operation, not unlike there was sincere anti-Axis action in World War II, and yet elements of the power establishment are on Al-Qaeda's side because they make a very useful proxy warrior and because of the Muslim Brotherhood's corporatist economics. It is a complex situation, but this is something we will go into at greater length in our next program. There then follows a discussion of the expansion of Al-Qaeda in this Bruce Hoffman paper, and then the conclusion is, the next section, the Arab Spring's big winner. The thousands of hardened Al-Qaeda fighters freed from Egyptian prisons in 2012-2013 by President Mohamed Morsi galvanized the Al-Qaeda movement at a critical moment when instability reigned and a handful of men well-versed in terrorism and subversion could plunge a country or a region into chaos. Whether in Libya, Turkey, Syria, or Yemen, their arrival was providential in terms of advancing Al-Qaeda's interests or increasing its influence. The military coup that subsequently toppled Morsi validated Zawahiri's repeated warnings not to believe Western promises about either the fruits of democracy or the sanctity of free and fair elections. It was Syria where Al-Qaeda's intervention proved most consequential. One of Zawahiri's first official acts after succeeding bin Laden as emir was to order a Syrian veteran of the Iraqi insurgency named Abu Muhammad al-Julani to return home and establish the Al-Qaeda franchise that would eventually become Jabhat al-Nusra. Hoffman also talks about how initially the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda were allied, but there was subsequently a schism which led to the two dividing. We will cover that in our next program. And again, bearing in mind that the Muslim Brotherhood is the parent organization of Al-Qaeda and was when Mohamed Morsi came to power in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood following the Arab Spring, that the revitalization of Al-Qaeda took place. Very briefly, from Newsweek magazine of July 3rd through 10th of 2006, Islam in Office by Stephen Glane. The Muslim Brotherhood hails 14th century philosopher Ibn Khaldun as its economic guide. Anticipating supply-side economics, Khaldun argued that cutting taxes raises production and tax revenues, and that state control should be limited to providing water, fire, and free grazing land, the utilities of the ancient world. The World Bank has called Ibn Khaldun the first advocate of privatization. His founding influence is a sign of moderation. If Islamists in power ever do clash with the West, it won't be over commerce. No, indeed. And by way of providing some perspective on this, from the New York Times of October 2nd of 1981 by Robert D. McFadden, Reagan cites Islamic scholar. President Reagan, in his news conference yesterday, cited a 14th century Islamic scholar as an early exponent of the supply-side economic theory on which his administration bases many of its policies. An authority on the scholar later said that the reference seemed accurate. Responding to a question about the effects of tax and spending cuts that began taking effect yesterday, Mr. Reagan said the supply-side principle dated back at least as far as Ibn Khaldun, who is generally regarded as the greatest Arab historian to emerge from the highly developed Arabic culture of the Middle Ages. Well, Reagan citing a Middle Ages theoretician is oddly appropriate, but the point being that although, you know, when I talk about Muslim Brotherhood, Ibn Khaldun et al., it seems like a long way from home. Well, it wasn't for Ronald Reagan. This concludes For the Record 1024. Ukrainian fascism, Maidan snipers, and the implications for the Syrian war. This is being recorded on September 11th of the year 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.